still I'm broke.
Hello and welcome to the Wire independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Annalisa Gracias. Coming up on The Wire today.
It excites me incredibly when I see someone doing CPR when I arrive, because what that means is I've got a good chance of seeing this patient survive.
We take a look at restarting a heart. If more people knew what to do, lives would be saved. And
on a Sunday afternoon in a Buenos Aires park, there aren't any protests or clashes, but there is a small music festival, and the group is here to play their song about Santiago.
In Argentina, thousands have been on the streets asking, "Where is Santiago Manaldo?" Deep in the south of Patagonia, the young Indigenous rights campaigner was lost, being chased by security forces. We find out what is being done to find him. Stay tuned for all this and more on The Wire Radio. Australia is about to become the 47th seat on the UN Human Rights Council. But Australia's refugee and asylum seeker policies, as well as its failure to address Indigenous health, education and incarceration, have attracted consistent criticism by UN bodies. So, will Australia's involvement be a great opportunity to improve its human rights record? Joanna Cabot has more.
Australia is about to be elected uncontested to the United Nations Human Rights Council today in New York. The country has campaigned globally for its position, arguing it will promote gender equality, good governance, freedom of expression, Indigenous rights and strong national human rights institutions. It is the most significant UN position Australia has sought since the Security Council. Anna Brown, the Director of Legal Advocacy at the Human Rights Law Centre in Australia, sees this new position as an opportunity for the country to improve its human rights records.
Relatively speaking, Australia is likely to be a positive force for reform on the council, but we also think it's a real opportunity for Australia to be a global leader and improve its human rights record, because it can't really be a true human rights leader if it continues to blatantly breach international law itself.
Diana Said, a crisis campaigner at Amnesty International, says Australia's human rights records have regressed in the last decades, but that despite the concerns, the organisation is hoping to see changes.
It's really concerning. It's definitely something that we have consistently criticised our government on, and it's particularly given that they've used national security and other reasons to trump up these restrictions and limitations on our individual rights and freedoms, which we have consistently said that it's not a proportionate response. All measures need to be taken to ensure national security, of course, but limiting people's rights to protest, excessive surveillance and metadata collection, the counter-terrorism laws that have been enacted throughout the last decade have not been proportionate a response in our opinion. So we are really concerned, and we maintain our concern for Australia and in this current bid for the seat on the UN Human Rights Council. We really do want to see them be better and show real leadership on human rights, and that starts at home.
Australia's asylum policies, as well as its failure to address Indigenous health, education and incarceration issues, have attracted consistent criticism by UN bodies. Anna Brown talks about the First Nations people rights.
Well, I think Australia's failure to grapple with issues such as ending Indigenous death in custody or protecting children from harm in its youth justice systems, along with, I think, what has been quite a stubborn refusal to accept rulings from UN experts or international criticism more broadly around Australia's cruel treatment of people in seeking asylum. I think all of these problems that Australia's failing to address cast serious doubt over whether it can maintain the high standards expected of council members. So we would look to Australia to really lift its game and start matching its talk in the international community with walking the walk and making sure that it really does improve the situation for Indigenous people in Australia.
Not only has Australia's position to be at the UN has been criticised, but other new countries like Mexico and Senegal have attracted similar criticism. So does the controversy regarding these countries affect the efficacy of the UN Human Rights Council? Anna Brown again.
The Human Rights Council is not a perfect mechanism. It's not a perfect institution that we try and improve the Human Rights Council and make sure that we try and advocate for countries to improve their domestic records when they get a seat on the UN Human Rights Council and also make a positive contribution to human rights globally. So whether it's Australia or a controversial country like Saudi Arabia, we need to be making sure that countries feel the weight of responsibility that they should be actively working to promote human rights and improve their own records at home.
Anna Brown and the Human Rights Law Centre will be watching closely and making sure that Australia is held to account at the international level and also in this country.
So making sure that when Australia makes statements to the international community about the position or the situation in other countries, that Australia is, for instance, making principled stands in support of human rights and condemning human rights abuses in our region, such as in Myanmar and the Philippines, rather than, you know, turning a blind eye to some serious abuses because these countries cooperate with Australia to prop up its punitive refugee policy. So we will be watching closely internationally in Geneva, but we'll also be making sure that when it comes to what Australia is doing back home, that together with many other NGOs and civil society organisations, that Australia is continuing to fulfil its commitments.
Anna Brown, the Director of Legal Advocacy at the Human Rights Law Centre in Australia, ending that report by Joanna Cabot. You may not have heard of the name Santiago Manaldo, but in Argentina his name is everywhere. Santiago is a 28-year-old Indigenous rights activist, last seen more than 2 months ago in Argentina's south on the frozen banks of a river in Patagonia. He was reportedly arrested protesting for the release of an imprisoned Mapuche leader, Joan Swala, who was detained for the illegal possession of firearms. The story goes that officers from the National Gendarmerie raided the camp of protesters on the site of the Mapuche land rights dispute. Witnesses have said many of the protesters dived into the river to escape, but Santiago, who can't swim, didn't follow. Across Argentina, people are asking, where is Santiago Monaldaro? But the campaign is more than a search for one man. Nina Copel reports from Buenos Aires.
In an apartment in the trendy Palermo suburb of Buenos Aires, a group of musicians pass around the traditional caffeinated brew mate. They exchange pages of lyrics, warm up their instruments and voices, and then they start to play. The song is called Donde Está, which means, where is he? This part of the song describes history repeating in Argentina, a reference to the Dirty War from 1974 to 1983, during which human rights groups say 30,000 people disappeared in Argentina.
Para poner en contexto, yo tengo 34 años.
This is Pablo, one of the musicians responsible for the song. He's 34 years old, and he was born in the year the military dictatorship ended. He's saying, I grew up, like my whole generation, in the shadow of that terrible memory, a kind of awareness of the importance of democracy, so as not to have to suffer the injustices, like the state disappeared a person and you can't do anything, and there aren't any resources or anyone to turn to ask, where is he? His face is everywhere across the country, printed on posters, taped to bus stops, and looking down on children playing in parks and plazas. People walk the streets wearing his face on T-shirts and graffiti the subways with his image. But the man himself is nowhere to be found. It's been over 2 months since he disappeared, but that hasn't dulled people's anger. And demonstrations are occurring across the country. They say Santiago's disappearance was handled wrong, that it should have been addressed more rapidly, especially when its possible security forces were involved. The government of Argentina is offering a $27,000 reward for his discovery, but that hasn't stopped the protests, some of which have ended in clashes with police. On a Sunday afternoon in a Buenos Aires park, there aren't any protests or clashes, but there is a small music festival, and the group is here to play their song about Santiago. I ask some of the people gathered how they feel about the situation. This man is telling me there seems to be a serious regression occurring in Argentina because they're asking for a person apparently disappeared in the hands of the repressive security force that is supposed to guarantee safety. This woman says, it seems to me a very sad situation, but unfortunately we're used to these situations. Here as well, it has a lot to do with the justice system. There are many things in disorder in this country. Back in Pablo's Palermo apartment, the group's finished rehearsing. They put down their instruments and explained to me why they made the song in the first place. Florencia, or Flor, is one of the singers, and she also plays the accordion in the song. She says the role of the state is changing before our eyes. The state has to guarantee constitutional rights and guarantee them for everyone. But at the same time, they have a special duty to the weakest. If it doesn't defend the women, if it doesn't defend the workers, if it doesn't defend the children, who is the state defending? She says, it seems to me that the pain can be a very powerful force, but we need to repurpose it so that we aren't paralyzed. And it seems to me that what we did was just to take that collective pain and to repurpose it through a beautiful song. Because our lives are finite. The artist is finite, our existence is finite, and we're going to leave, but the art remains. Something I heard in an interview some time ago with Victor Jara, who's one of my favorite artists, was that they tortured, they killed, they murdered during the Pinochet dictatorship. But his songs continue to be sung, and they live with all of us. And the same will pass with this song. So when we are not here anymore, this song will continue to exist, and anyone who identifies with it will be able to make it their own.
Nina Copel ending that report. Today is Restart a Heart Day. Most of us have had someone close to us or in our community experience cardiac arrest. But how many of us know how to respond in this situation? I asked Alan Morrison, New South Wales Ambulance Director of Education, how we can restart a heart during a cardiac arrest.
So someone in cardiac arrest, their heart has stopped pumping blood. So that means that there's no blood going to the brain or the heart. The brain deprived of oxygen, you become unconscious very quickly, and that's the first key sign. The first is unconscious. The second is no signs of life. That is, they're not moving at all. They're not displaying signs of life. The third one is absent or abnormal breathing. So if a person is unconscious with no signs of life and absent or abnormal breathing, they're in cardiac arrest.
He says it's imperative to act right away as soon as signs of cardiac arrest are identified.
In terms of cardiac arrest, it's absolutely essential that people start cardiac compressions as soon as they notice the person is in cardiac arrest. If they wait for an ambulance to arrive, even when the ambulance gets there as quickly as it can, it will negatively impact the chance of survival.
As an intensive care paramedic, Alan has seen firsthand the positive impact of community members conducting CPR at the scene prior to the arrival of paramedics. He has also witnessed the loss of life when bystanders are unable to respond appropriately.
I've seen times when members of the public or family are doing CPR when we arrive, and sadly I've seen when people are standing around just watching the person who's unconscious on the ground. The people who I've seen revive and return to a normal life are those who've had someone start CPR before we arrive. Now, it excites me incredibly when I see someone doing CPR when I arrive, because what that means is I've got a good chance of seeing this patient survive the cardiac arrest. When there's no CPR, I feel quite disappointed, because the chances of survival are going to be relatively low.
Alan says it's never too early or too late to learn CPR.
As soon as you're big enough to push on a chest, which is quite young children, and it's never too late. It doesn't matter how old you are, if you've got physical capability, then you can do CPR.
Automatic external defibrillators, or AEDs, are used within the first 3 to 5 minutes to save lives during a cardiac arrest. Some Australians are hesitant to use such high-powered medical equipment, but Alan assures they can be used by virtually anyone with little or no medical experience.
AEDs nowadays are designed to be usable without any formal instruction. So if there is an AED available, and sometimes you'll often find them now in public places attached to the wall, like a fire extinguisher. If you pull it off the wall, it will activate a response automatically to that location. When you turn them on, they tell you exactly what to do. And then that machine will only deliver a shock to the person in cardiac arrest if the computer inside that machine detects that it is a rhythm that can be shocked. So they're completely safe to use. You don't need training. And if they're available, turn them on and follow the instructions. They're extremely simple to use.
There are numerous courses to learn CPR, and community initiatives are available across Australia.
Often people do first aid courses, and there's multiple suppliers of first aid courses, and you'll learn a range of things there, not just CPR. So there are literally hundreds of opportunities to learn CPR in the community. In New South Wales, you could even contact the New South Wales Australian Resuscitation Council branch, of which I'm the chair, and we can help to provide some basic CPR instruction as well.
Too many Australians don't survive cardiac arrest, and these programs are aimed at improving the issue. Alan urges the community to share the message via social media and other platforms.
So there's days like today, which is Restart a Heart Day, both here and overseas, and certainly take up that message, share that message with their friends, and simply through all of their networks say, listen, if somebody looks like they're in heart attack, don't be scared, don't be hesitant, don't be concerned. Jump in, put your hands in the centre of the chest and start compressing that person's chest about 120 compressions a minute. Call for an ambulance and know that when you call 000, if a person's in cardiac arrest, the ambulance person on the other end of the line will give instructions on what to do as well and stay with you until paramedics arrive on the phone. So there's no reason not to get involved. If everybody started telling everybody else about that message, we would see cardiac arrest survival rates go from one out of every 10 in this country to significantly greater, maybe up to close to 50%.
Each state of Australia is conducting workshops and initiatives to support the education of its communities with this important issue. Kate Kroger, the Community Education Manager at Ambulance Victoria, says she's excited to get the community involved through activities and programs in schools as well as workplaces.
In partnership with all of the Australian Ambulance Services and New Zealand, we are excited to be running about 30 activities around the state, just getting everyday people, whether they're in their workplace or their school, involved in knowing how to do CPR and how to access and use a defibrillator.
Kate's main aim is to give people the opportunity to have a go and become comfortable in performing CPR.
Raising awareness and giving people options to actually get in and just have a go at CPR. So we've got mannequins and we've got different devices that people are then practicing.
There is plenty of resources and information available to the public. Anyone can learn to save a life.
Check out the Ambulance Victoria website And we've also got social media channels of Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And you can find links then to videos helping to demonstrate. And there's also a lot of local providers that then, if people wanted to, could follow up with certified training.
For more information on how to get involved in your local area, visit the Restart a Heart Day website, www.restartaheart.net, and use the hashtag #RestartAHeart. The initiative was created in conjunction with ambulance services of each state and territory.
Get out there and have a go today, as we just want to show people the three simple steps of call, push and shock.
Kate Kroger ending that report. I'm Annalisa Gracias. An ambitious program spanning over a dozen Victorian prisoners is helping Indigenous offenders rehabilitate through painting. Prisoners and former prisoners are reconnecting with their heritage by telling stories of their culture. Nicole Ng has the story.
Painting keeps me focused on doing one thing instead of doing another, like going out and getting in trouble, all that sort of stuff.
Graham Gilbert, also known as Gil the Painter, is a Wiradjuri man from central New South Wales. His art tells the story of his identity and culture, but he only began to make it his life and livelihood during his time in prison. It's a story of resilience and just one of dozens emerging from a program in Victoria which aims to help support Indigenous inmates through culture and by helping them earn money and by helping them sell their artworks to earn money.
What some followers don't understand why they do the stuff they do to be put themselves in there, and this is a rehabilitation for the younger fellows and the girls to know where they come from, got their identity and all that, their sort of stuff. And it gives the younger fellows better literacy that helps them with the stories to go through camp.
The Torch program works with Indigenous offenders in 13 prisons, supporting hundreds of inmates during their sentence and post-release. CEO Kent Morris says he felt compelled to develop the program because of his own personal experience struggling with identity.
I built the program on my lived experience, and my experiences formed around my father being separated from his family. That separation transcended down into our family. And so I found it very difficult to find a place in the world that was fortunate enough for the Aboriginal community, particularly here in Victoria, to support me to find my cultural heritage. I feel really fortunate to have had the support that I had. And realistically, all of the groundwork and the structure of this program is built on the support I was given by the community. So it's time-honoured. I didn't invent it or design it. I'm just passing on that kind of support I was given.
Mr. Morris says his feeling of being estranged from his Indigenous heritage isn't an isolated one. When building the program, he asked Indigenous communities what they were looking for.
No one said they wanted to learn about art. They all asked me, you know, can you tell me my totem? I don't know my family history. I've never seen a photo of my great-grandmother. What's our, can I learn my lingo, you know, for our Asian stories? Everyone wants to understand more about their culture. And that was the real signifying point, that art was a very secondary concern. The main thing was trying to learn more about identity.
Indigenous people can feel more alienated if they're not anchored by a strong sense of identity.
We need to understand who we are and where we're from and our cultural identity. And a lot of the men and women in the program, when I first went out to speak to them, we found together that we had such shared stories of disconnection from family and culture and not understanding who we were, not finding a way to feel comfortable in the world because of that. And that the arts had a way to really heal that gap.
The Torch helps those caught up in the justice system prepare for release by creating new and positive communities.
Breaking old behavioural habits, finding new connections, new networks of friends and community members away from what may have been in the past, ones that could maintain that kind of cycle of offending. For men and women who often feel that there isn't a place for them, to make sure that they're kind of carving out a place for themselves through their ability to connect back to the community through the art.
Gil the Painter says the Torch program helps him focus and gave him a source of income. He says that the fact that the Torch helps inmates become more independent makes it different from other programs.
While I was there, I made a couple of dollars for myself out of my artwork, and I've sent that to my family while I was in before my pre-release. So I basically don't like asking my family for money, and that helps them out with bills, school fees, everything like that. Kent's program, it helps provide for the fellas in there that's got no income that comes from family. They can learn it, like structure themselves to stand on their own 2 feet, and they can provide their parent family with some money as well.
The program has given this artist solace and focus, and it's sure to help many more find their way.
I'm standing on the deck, got a few trees bare around at the moment. just basically being with family and knowing that I can provide for my family through my artwork, and I can provide for them that way without doing the wrong thing.
Graham Gilbert, Indigenous painter, ending that report by Nicole Ng. That's all for The Wire today. The Wire is a team effort by Radio 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4AB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Annalisa Gracias. Thank you for your company.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
From a tradition. Watching by fire cooking in the kitchen. Watching the kettle steams, the level bubble over. From a rooftop overlooking the city, the kettle whistles a signal. I had to pen out. Documented ripples of rings and rings. Redeemed Hannibal study strategy. Got semi-anatomy. My mentality gradually.